Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Well, it's supposed to be good morning. It's supposed to be 8 o'clock in the morning. However, this morning, what I failed to do was I failed to hit the record button. So it is now 2 o'clock and I am re-recording this lecture from this morning. So we're just going to pretend that it's 8 o'clock in the morning. It is Tuesday. We'll say it's 8 o'clock. And this is Chem30A lab lecture for September 29th. Okay. What we were doing today was a worksheet that is called Compounds and Their Formulas. This is Activity 5. And I've reloaded Activity 5 up onto the website so that you've got an activity now that has all of the components that is identical to what I'm going to show you here. This morning we had some differences in the activities and I've re-uploaded it, put in the right activity so that you all should be squared. So let me start a screen share here with you and share with my iPad. This should do it. Seems like that's working, seems like that's recording. Okay, and real quick, let's just show you where we're at in terms of the Canvas shell. We are in chapter 3, so this is module 3. And within module 3, we are looking at activity 5. And activity 5 has a pre-lab lecture that Krista has done that is in there. There is a click for download the activity, compounds and the formulas. And then there's a video that Krista has also put together that shows some of these compounds. And there's pictures of the various compounds here. We can use some of these. We can look at some of these. But I think I have some other interesting photos to be able to show you this morning as well. And Krista and I have talked. Like I said, Krista has her pre-lab lectures in here as well. Krista and I had a conversation over email the other day regarding Krista putting in her lab lectures within our lab section in the Canvas shell. And she was concerned. She had done it automatically on accident and then decided that maybe she might take it out and then thought, well, we should have a conversation. And my comment was, I'm going to continue doing my live lectures regardless of what materials Krista puts online. And that I thought it was just another opportunity for students to learn. And so if you want to view Krista's lab lectures as well and see what she has going on and view mine as well, it's just one more opportunity for you guys to learn, and more always seems to be better. So I said, let's just leave it up there, and it makes no difference on my end on how I'm going to treat things and how I'm going to go about doing my lab lectures. So that's why those are there. Okay, from there, let's go take a look at the activity itself and what we're going to be doing. So this is compounds and their formulas. And the goal here really is to understand what a compound is, the different types of compounds, and the understanding of what their formulas mean. So we're not doing nomenclature, and we're not doing the naming of these compounds today. Really what we're looking at is trying to understand the compounds and how they are different from ionic materials to covalent materials, and what the formulas actually mean in terms of the subscripts that are placed into these formulas. So the first thing that we want to do is we want to look at the types of bonds that are in compounds here. And I'm going to also work from my notes this morning to try to make them as consistent as I can. So that's just a little note about what I'm going to be doing as I'm bouncing back and forth and looking at my notes as well, which I should review just really quick to see where I started. Okay, let's start with what a compound is and then the different types of compounds. And then we'll come back here and we'll look at everything that this thing wants us to do. So we're going to skip down to the bottom. I'm going to create a new page where I'm going to start my notes. And it doesn't seem to want to add the page. There it goes. Okay. So page 8, for some reason, is missing. I think we can find it. There we go. All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about compounds. And within these compounds, what we have are combinations of elements in fixed whole number ratios. And this is really important that it is not ratios, ratios. This is really important that it is fixed whole numbers. The example that we gave was water and hydrogen peroxide, H2O2. Okay, these fixed whole number ratios, and we can imagine that when there isn't a number shown, that we understand that number to be a one. So the fixed whole number ratios here are these ratios, which are 2-to-1 ratio of hydrogen to oxygen versus a 2-to-2 or 1-to-1 ratio of hydrogen and oxygen. And the idea here is that water is a combination of hydrogen and oxygen that has the properties that we understand to be water that's necessary for life, that we drink every day. Hydrogen peroxide is a combination of hydrogen and oxygen where there are two oxygens connected to each other. And that hydrogen peroxide is a very different type of compound. It's actually an extremely dangerous compound in high concentrations. When it gets up to 35%, it can severely burn you. But when you buy it at the drugstore in a 5% or 3% solution, hydrogen peroxide is an antiseptic. It kills bacteria on contact. And the way that it does that is it interacts with the enzymes on the outside of the bacterial wall, and it oxidizes those enzymes, destroying them. And in the process, converts into oxygen, and that oxygen gas bubbles, and that's the bubbling sensation that we see when we pour it into a wound. It is both that it is interacting with the enzymes in the bacteria, but it is also interacting with the enzymes within you, and it is killing and damaging some of your skin cells within the wound area. Not significantly so, just enough to be able to produce the oxygen, but that oxygen causes the bacteria then to be lifted out of the wound, and it cleanses the wound. So it both kills, destroys them, and removes them from the wound, but has very different properties than if we just pour water over that wound. And so these two materials, water and hydrogen peroxide, are very different materials with very different physical properties, different boiling points, different chemical reactivities, different physical appearances. They are completely different compounds because their ratios are different. But when we find water, water is always 2 hydrogens to 1 oxygen. And if we ever find 2 hydrogens to 2 oxygens, then that is hydrogen peroxide, and that is something different. So this idea of fixed, meaning that they do not vary, and always in whole numbers. You will never find them in 1.5 or 1.7 to 1. So they always come in whole number fixed ratios. And the other idea is that within these compounds, we have two different types of compounds. We have compounds which are called ionic. Ionic compounds are compounds where we have a cation, positively charged, and an anion, negatively charged. And these positive and negative charges are held together by what are called electrostatic attractions. The idea that opposite charges attract. We call that electrostatic. So that's electrostatic attraction. And the idea here is that we have elements that will react. Let's see if I left myself enough room here. I'm going to scoot things up just a little bit to make a little more room so I don't slide onto the next slide. That'll work. The idea here is that if we take elements such as sodium, a metal, and chloride, a nonmetal, and they're in their elemental form, that they can share or trade, not share, but trade an electron such that sodium can give up an electron to chloride. And in so doing, sodium becomes a cation and now has no valence electrons or has lost that valence electron. Chloride now has 8 valence electrons and as such has a negative ion. And these then are an ionic compound. And that ionic compound is written as NaCl, We don't include the charges in the ionic compound. We simply write them together, and the charges are implied as to be there. So how do I know that this is actually an ionic compound? Well, what we do is we look at this piece right here. This is a metal. And in looking at the metal tells us that this is going to be an ionic compound. So metals don't form what are called covalent bonds. I'm going to show that in just a second. Metals form ionic bonds. They form cations and anions. And so we look for that metal, and that this is an example of an ionic compound. So what we're doing is we're coordinating metal with ionic, so that that idea of a metal means that the compound is going to be ionic in nature, comprised of cations and anions. The other type of compound that we're going to look at is a covalent compound. Covalent compounds differ from ionics in that the electrons are shared here. In the sharing of electrons, one of the best examples we can show is that if we bring hydrogen together, and these are atomic hydrogens, and we slide them together and we get them close enough that they come within bonding range, what happens is the hydrogens share the electrons between them. Rather than one becoming a cation and one becoming an anion, what they do is they take these electrons, which are their valence electrons. And those valence electrons, the idea of a valence electron is the outermost electron. And it is the outermost electrons that when we bring atoms together that can be shared. And when they are shared, they're shared in an orbital that is the outermost orbital. And another word that we use for these orbitals sometimes is a valence. And this is then what we call a covalence because it is a shared valence. And because we call that a covalence or a shared valence, that's where the word covalent comes from. And this now is a molecule. Molecule, using that word molecule, differently than ionic compound. So the differences here between ionic and covalent is that one is molecular, one is a molecule, and one is an ionic compound. And we use those terms molecular to mean, or molecule to mean something which is sharing electrons, which is covalent. So those words go together. And the bonding here is the sharing of electrons. Bonding is covalent equals sharing of electrons. And the other idea here is that these are all nonmetals. Covalent compounds are comprised of all nonmetals. We won't see any metals in these compounds when we look at them. So when we think about metals, the next thing to really talk about when we think about a metal is to look at a periodic table. Since we've brought metals into this, let's bring a periodic table into this and let's look at a periodic table. Okay, so here's our periodic table that we can look at now. And bring this guy back so we have our notes. Within the periodic table, we have a division here between metals and nonmetals. And the things that are up against this line, we call them metalloids. The metalloids have properties of metals and nonmetals. But beyond the metalloids, we have distinct metals, which are on the left-hand side of the table. And we have nonmetals on the right-hand side. These guys that are on the right-hand side are going to be both covalent and ionic, or form both covalent and ionic types of compounds. Whereas the metals, for our purposes, are going to be ionic compounds only. Okay, so let's look at these in a little bit more detail. So as we look at these metals, the metals span everything that are over here in the S block and everything that is in and up until including our line here, everything that's in this D block. So we're gonna get all these guys here. And while these are all of our metals, and then I'm sort of avoiding the metalloids, all right, close enough. While we're looking at these, the metals that we're going to see most frequently are lithium, beryllium, magnesium, potassium, calcium. These guys we'll see a lot. Strontium, we might see him quite a bit too. Chromium, manganese, iron, cobalt, nickel. These are very common metals, along with copper, silver, and gold. We'll see some zinc, some tin and lead. We'll see those quite frequently. I'm looking to see if there's anything else that's popping out at me here that we see a lot. And those are pretty much our most common metals that we'll be looking for and seeing a lot of those metals. And then, maybe aluminum too is really more of a true metal. And we see a lot of aluminum. Then when we go to the nonmetals over here are all of these guys, boron, carbon, and I'm gonna stay away from, at this time, I'm gonna stay away from the noble gases because the noble gases really don't participate in bonding. So it's really these guys that participate in bonding. And all of these, we'll see boron and carbon and nitrogen and fluorine a lot. We'll see phosphorus and sulfur a lot and chlorine and bromine and iodine. Selenium, not quite as much. But there's one thing that I do really want to point out here that's important, and that's hydrogen. Because hydrogen, although it's on the metal side, hydrogen being so small, reacts like a nonmetal. And we will see it almost exclusively in covalent compounds. While it can do ionic, and like I said, the nonmetals can do ionic as well, so hydrogen fits in within that category. Hydrogen, based on its size and its orbitals, likes to bond covalently quite frequently. So we'll see hydrogen acting as a nonmetal for the purposes of this discussion. Okay, let's go back and take a look at the worksheet and some of the things that they want us to do in the worksheet. Okay, so one of the things here, and this was informational, and this will go along with what we were just saying, is that when I look at the worksheet here, what we find is that I can look for those metals, sodium. Let me turn down my pen here to a smaller. I can look for sodium, magnesium, and that when I see those metals as being a part of these compounds, and remember a compound can be either ionic or covalent, when I see a metal in the compound, I know that it's an ionic compound. And so it's going to be comprised of ions and the bonding type is going to be ionic. The nonmetals, when I look at the nonmetals, carbon and chlorine are a nonmetal, nitrogen, hydrogen are a nonmetal, bromine is a nonmetal. If there are no metals and all of them are nonmetals, then it becomes referred to as a molecule, and the bonding style is a shared electron bonding style, covalent. Same thing here, two nonmetals, molecules, covalent. And what I did this morning too is these seemed overly simplistic to me. I got concerned that these are binary combinations. Binary combinations meaning comprised of only two elements. And many of our ionic compounds and covalent compounds will have many more than two elements within them. So when we look at those, examples would be here that I could have things like lead, Pb, acetate. Acetate is C2H3O2. And there are four of these within that compound. All I need to do, I don't need to worry about anything else that's going on this. All I need to do is hone in on lead. Lead is a metal. And because this is a metal, and the rest of these are nonmetals, but because of the presence of the metal, that tells me that this thing is ionic. So there are nonmetals present, but this is ions, and it is a lead, which is a 4+, and it is C2H3O2, which is negatively charged, which is the ion, and this is an ionic type of bonding. So again, I'm cueing into the idea of that metal, ions, and ionic. Another idea here, to show you a covalent one that has more than just two atoms or elements in it, we can look at C12H24O11. This is a molecule of what is called sucrose. This is table sugar. This is the type of sugar that you eat. This is comprised of all nonmetals, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, and a lot of them. And so this is going to be molecule. Oh, two nonmetals first. That's what we should list. So this is many nonmetals. And that means that this is a molecule and that it is covalent. So there we go. Molecules and covalent. So a bunch of different examples. Okay. In this first part, experiment part A, in part A, they want us to work on interpreting some formulas and observe some compounds in the laboratory display. And we were given some compounds to be able to look at. In part B, there's an experiment which I'm going to explain in detail, and we'll talk about that experiment, and then we'll fill in some of these things together. So that's it, part A, part B. Let's look at part A for a second. Here's part A, interpreting the compounds and formulas that we find in the lab. Now, these were supposed to be these elements here, and compounds. Krista had taken pictures of the compounds. Here's chromium oxide and this green color that we see here. Here is a zinc chromate and a warning label that this is dangerous for the respiratory system. But while it's sealed in the test tube, perfectly safe to handle, and that zinc chromate is yellow in color. Calcium sulfate, which is a purple color, and potassium dichromate, which is a great red color. So an iron oxide, which is sort of a deep red color. These were compounds that we were able to hold, but these compounds have been crushed, powdered, and are in a more refined powdered state rather than in their crystalline state. So I like to kind of observe them in both. And what our worksheet has to start off with is an example where they detailed it out for us, copper sulfate, and this is copper 2 sulfate. So this compound, if this compound were to be named, it would be called copper Roman numeral 2 sulfate. And it's deep blue crystals. And what I wanna do is I wanna show you those deep blue crystals and what they look like. So I'm gonna hop on over to a an app that I purchased last night. This is an app that is by, let's see if I can get to, it's a set of apps that he's put out. Let me go to the home screen. So this is Theodore Gray's The Elements. And this is a periodic table that is sort of a live, living periodic table where you can view many of the elements. You can rotate them around. For instance, if we wanted to see copper, they have a demonstration of what copper looks like as a refined element rather than being in its ore. This is a copper link chain that is highly polished and has that color and property of copper that we would expect to see. Sulfur, if we go back and we look at sulfur, sulfur in its elemental state looks like a yellow sort of stone, an amorphous stone, and it has sort of a waxy appearance to it, but it doesn't feel waxy at all when you touch it. It feels like any other rock as you touch it, maybe a little bit softer, but it certainly is a very hard rock and appears just like this in small chunks. And oxygen, when we look at it, they don't have a good representation of oxygen here in this periodic table. What they have is oxygen that has been cooled down to very, very cold temperatures. I can't remember what the boiling point, actually it has it on there for me. The melting point is, the boiling point is minus 182 degrees Celsius, minus 297 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's the temperature of that liquid oxygen there. And when you cool it down to that cold and it becomes liquid, it has this bluish cast to it, very beautiful material. And here they're taking a splint that is a burning splint, putting it close to the oxygen vapors hit it and accelerate the combustion, as we know that oxygen is needed for combustion. And so that's the whole idea of placing that splint close to it and watching it catch on fire. Okay, so there's oxygen. Well, let's take and go back to Theodore Gray's Molecules. And this is an app where he's not dealing with elements, but with actual molecules and compounds, both ionic and covalent. And here is a representation of the copper 2-sulfate or cupric sulfate. And these models you can also rotate and look at. And it said that these were beautiful blue crystals, and indeed they are. We see that these are extraordinarily deep blue crystals that are here that are of the copper sulfate, copper 2-sulfate. And let's go back now and let's look at our worksheet and what they wanted us to do. They wanted us to describe those crystals, the physical properties, just describing what they physically look like. They wanted us to then take the formula that was given, copper, one sulfur, four oxygens, and take the subscripts and pull them up one subscript in front of each element to denote how many of each of those elements we have. So there is one copper atom, there is one sulfur atom, and there are four oxygen atoms. That's what the interpretation of the subscripts are. They're the enumeration of how many of each of those elements we have in the formula. And then they also wanted us to take and describe the physical properties, or the physical appearance is really what it should say, of each one of those elements individually as it went into that compound. So you take copper, which is the shiny copper metal that we looked at. You take the sulfur, which is this yellow chunks, and oxygen, which is a colorless gas. You combine them in these ratios of 1:1:4, and you get that beautiful copper 2 sulfate. So that's the goal of what they wanted us to do here. And I have some other compounds that are, I can't exactly cue them up, but I can switch to them and we can look at some of these different compounds. So I think this morning, what we started out at looking at was here, this one. This is ferrous sulfate or iron 2 sulfate. And this is a crystal of the iron 2 sulfate. This is how it would appear in a crystalline form. Just, I don't know how big that crystal is, but I imagine that it's probably a little bit smaller than your finger, about finger size that is there. And they also have another combination, other ratio of iron and sulfur. and sulfate. And so this is, I think it is the iron 3 sulfate. And it is, I can see it in the formula there. So the iron 3 sulfate has a different appearance to it. It's a little more gray in color, or maybe sort of light brown in color, as opposed to the white that we see here for the iron 2 sulfate. So even the ratios, remember, as I said, water, H2O, right? And if you change the ratios to H2O2, it becomes a different compound with different physical properties. Indeed, the ratios, as the ratios of these two compounds change, their physical appearance changes, their melting point changes, their chemical reactivity changes, everything changes, and they become a new molecule. So the ratios are extremely important to what the molecule is. Let's take this one, this formula that is on the left-hand side, one iron to one sulfur to four oxygens, iron two sulfate, and let's include that in our worksheet. So what we would do here is we would say FeSO4, this is iron Roman numeral 2 sulfate. And notice that the ratios, one iron to one sulfur to four oxygens, one copper to one sulfur to four oxygens, this was a white flaky crystal. And its ratios are one iron to one sulfur to four oxygens. And we can look at iron, we can look at the sulfur and the oxygen. We know that the sulfur is that yellow chunk material. We can say that it looks like a rock. Oxygen is the odorless, colorless gas. And let's go look at iron real quick. Oops, wrong one. Here we go. We will go back to the home screen and we'll find iron on there. Now, this is a piece of iron that has been formed into a horseshoe, but iron, as we have seen many times over our lifetimes, is a shiny, hard, dense metal, very, very strong. It can be bent, it can be hammered and shaped without breaking, so it is not brittle, but it is the opposite of brittle. It is what we call malleable. So malleable is that, is my dog deciding to bark here. Give them a second to maybe stop barking. Hey, maybe not. They might try. Okay, so the iron is a gray, shiny, hard metal. And it's really hard to grasp how these are so different, in that just changing the metal, the iron for the copper, makes one of these a brilliant blue color and sort of translucent, whereas the other one is that opaque white flaky crystal material. So we're looking at here, this one that I'm rotating as the one with the iron in it. And the other one is the one with the copper in it. And those couldn't be more different just by changing the metal. So that means that because they both contain sulfate and a difference in the metal, that really the color difference that we're seeing here has more to do with the metal than it does with the sulfate. And really what we're seeing when we look at these two different compounds is that metals in particular tend to absorb visible light. And it's has to do with the electron band gap between the orbitals. So when we look at the orbitals that all the electrons are packed into, when light hits those orbitals, it can take the electrons and excite them up to a higher level orbital. And it absorbs energy based on the distance that the electron is traveling. So if we take and we look at an idea here, let's go down to the bottom of our screen. And let's look at this idea of color and where color comes from. When we look at the orbitals within the metal have orbitals that have electrons in them and orbitals that do not. This is the metal for the most part, but this is also true of organic compounds. So this is not only metals. This can be metals or it can be a compound. Light, when light comes in, it comes in on different wavelengths. So we have long wavelengths and we have short wavelengths. Light can excite one of these electrons up to a higher energy level. And when it excites that electron up to a higher energy level, when the light is absorbed, it absorbs energy that is equal to the distance that the electron jumps. Once that electron jumps, it absorbs energy of that wavelength. So let's say that this was the long wavelength, and this was the short, and this was the medium wavelength. Whatever wavelength that happened to be, let's say that it absorbs the medium wavelength. That means that my long wavelength that was coming in here bounces off and comes back out. And my short wavelength that was coming in here, it bounces off and comes back as the short wavelength. And what gets absorbed is that medium wavelength. And so when something appears to be blue to your eye, what you're looking at that happens to be sort of this blue crystal, the idea of its blueness is the idea that that red and green and other colors are being absorbed. And so if I'm looking at the wavelengths of colors that are coming into this, what's bouncing off of this that's coming and bouncing back to my eye is the blue wavelength. And that's the wavelength that I'm seeing. The other wavelength that might be a red wavelength or a yellow wavelength or something is being absorbed. And so what we're seeing literally when we see the color of a compound is we're seeing the colors that are bouncing off it, not the colors that are being absorbed by it. And so we're seeing the loss of the colors in that spectrum that are being absorbed by the compound. And we're only seeing the reflected light. And that's where the color comes from. And that is true for everything that is colored. That is true for things that are organic molecules as well as things that are covalent molecules. Okay, so that's where color comes from. Or a little idea about that color. Oh, and what I was going to say here is that the electrons go up. And then at some point, we say that this is in an excited state. It relaxes back down by giving off heat, or sometimes by giving off light for things that are fluorescent, but usually for molecules that are not giving off their own light, it's relaxing through emitting heat. So it has absorbed energy and it has to give off that energy in some other form, usually heat, vibrational energy or rotational energy, or just moving faster and thereby being hotter in that regard. So that's where the energy goes. Okay. Let's go and look at another compound. We've done a little aside about color now. Let's go pick another compound to look at and see what we can do. All right, there's a ferric or ferrous carbonate, this one. This is a good one to do too. In this case, what we have done is this one is a picture of a crystalline material, which is one iron, one carbon and three oxygens. So this one is iron to carbonate. And let's go and look at this one and put it on the screen. So this is an iron CO3, and this is iron Roman numeral 2 carbonate. The names of these things, we're going to do at a later date. We do a whole chapter on what's called nomenclature, and we'll do multiple worksheets and multiple activities on nomenclature, on learning how to name these compounds. So right now, don't worry about the names. We'll throw names at you just so that we have or can refer to them by name, but you're not going to be naming them just yet. This is a brown crystalline material. It's comprised of one iron, one carbon, and three oxygen. So we have iron, we have carbon, and we have oxygen. The iron we've already described as gray and shiny. The carbon, we haven't described. Oxygen, colorless gas. And the carbon, this is a dull gray material. The best way to describe carbon, and I don't have good pictures of carbon, but is of graphite, a pencil lead. So if you take a mechanical pencil lead and you look at that, that is carbon. Now, carbon has multiple forms. This is the most common form, is what we see is the dull gray sort of powder or black powder. That's the other way. So dull gray solid or as a black powder. But the other form of carbon that is naturally occurring is this one. Where's our carbon? There we go. A diamond. So diamond is also a form of carbon, a very pure carbon. So that diamond is just a different arrangement, crystal structure of the carbon itself. In this case, the carbons are very highly organized in a crystal lattice structure that allows light to be passed through it. So it becomes clear as light passes through it rather than opaque like the graphite. And it also becomes much, much harder, very, very dense in this form. So this is a natural form of carbon as well. And that is true for not only carbon, but some of the other elements have multiple crystal structure types. And we can see that in their elemental state, we can see different crystal structures for some of them. And carbon is one of them. So that's a cool one. All right. I think that's enough for the worksheet itself. For that part A, we don't need to do four of those, but we should answer these questions. And these questions students tend to have a lot of trouble with. I think it's partly because of the wording, but also because these are new concepts. And so let's answer these first couple ones together here. And I'm gonna leave you enough to do. You're gonna have plenty to do by the end of this worksheet. When elements combine to form compounds, are the physical properties of the compound the same as those of the elements? Explain. So when elements combine to form compounds, are the physical properties of the compound the same as those of the elements? This is getting to this idea here, the physical properties of the elements themselves versus the physical properties of the compounds that they form. And the idea here is that they are not the same at all, that they are very different, that when I take and I combine these elements into compounds, the compounds take on whole new physical properties. So the answer here is no. The elements have very different physical properties. From the compounds they form. They have different appearances. They look different. They have different chemical properties. Both chemical and physical. Okay, and the next one here, does the formula of a compound vary or is matter constant in composition? So what they're asking here is they're asking, for instance, water, H2O. Can it be H3O or H4O or H3O2 or H2O2? This would be varying if the ratios varied. And the idea here is that water is constant and it does not vary. Water is always H2O. It does not vary. And so what we're saying is that matter is constant. In its ratios. Of elements that comprise it. So we find that the elements are in fixed whole number ratios. That's the whole idea that we were doing there, is that this is fixed whole number ratios. And that's what we're looking for in that answer. Okay, this next part, physical properties of iron, iron sulfide and its elements. This one is an experiment that we generally do. And here what they want you to do is they want you to look at iron, sulfur, iron plus sulfur, and something that we call iron 2 sulfide. And they want the physical properties of these things, their density, their melting point, their boiling point, magnetic attraction, reaction with HCl. This is an experiment that we need to do together. And so rather than film this experiment, we're going to talk about it. And I think that we can do it justice in terms of just talking about this experiment and what actually happens with it. So let's take a look at this and see what we can do here. First off, the way that we're going to do this is we're going to take each one of these materials and put them into a test tube. So this is part B. And this is the experimental part. So we're going to have four different test tubes. And we're going to put these different things in the test tubes. So let's make a set of test tubes first. And for consistency, we'll draw a test tube. And then what we'll do is copy that and paste it in here a few times. Okay, so four different test tubes. And what we've got in the first test tube is iron. And these are little spheres, little ball bearings essentially of iron. And these guys, the iron is gray in color. So this is our iron. And the sulfur, rather than having the rocks or chunks of sulfur, we're going to have a sulfur powder. And so these are going to be smaller sort of powdered material. And it'll have a few little sulfur chunks that are in there too, a little more rock-like. And these were sort of a pretty bright yellow color. So this is our sulfur. And then we have a mixture of elements. This is the iron plus the sulfur. And here what we do is we take and we put a few of these pieces of iron in here, which sit in the bottom. And then there is also some of that powder that is the sulfur that flows around them. And so we have the sulfur that is in this. And then these little spheres of iron that are in there. And so that's our mixture. And then the last thing is ionic compound. And here, this is an ionic compound that is iron, Roman numeral 2, sulfide. And this is written FES and is meant to be read iron, which is a 2+, and sulfur, which is a 2-. And they are forming a compound that is held together by electrostatic attraction. And this compound is a dull gray compound that looks a little bit like graphite, but is a little bit darker than the iron would be. So we'll darken that in a couple of times. So there's our iron sulfide, and it doesn't have any of the nodules of iron in it. It is all evenly, finely divided and homogeneous. There's a word that we used before. Remember the definition of homogeneous, meaning consistent throughout, so that there are not high concentrations of iron and higher concentrations of sulfur. It is evenly distributed so that it is always one iron to one sulfur, no matter how small you finally divide it. If we were to count all the irons and all the sulfurs, there will always be a one-to-one ratio, because that's the way that the compound is. Now, the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to do a magnetic test. So we're going to take a test with a magnet, and we're going to test each one of these test tubes with a magnet. So what we'll do is we'll grab these, and we may change the labels on these a little bit as we go through, and we're going to do a magnetic test. We're going to take a magnet and apply a magnet to these and see how they react, whether or not they're actually magnetic or not. So to do that with the magnet, what we do is we take, I thought that was going to lock in for me. I don't think it's going to. I think I'll just have to draw a magnet. Okay, so here's our magnet. And rather than a little bar magnet, we'll make it like a horseshoe magnet. And this horseshoe magnet has positive and negative ends to the magnet. And what we're going to do is we're going to move the magnet up and down. And several of the spheres, the magnet can hold onto them. And the spheres will go up and down with the magnet. And so that this is magnetic in nature. And we're able to move the iron up and down as the magnet holds on to those iron spheres. When we take the magnet and try to do the same thing with the sulfur, we find that there is no ability to be able to grab the spheres and move them. It doesn't do anything. And so these are magnetic. Not magnetic. Let's check the mixture. What happens when we do the mixture, interestingly enough, is that we are able to grab the iron. So if we move this down, we can grab the iron, and several of the iron spheres will come out of this mixture. In fact, we can grab nearly all of the iron spheres. And the iron spheres will hold up here, and what's left in the bottom is the sulfur. So the sulfur gets stuck behind, whereas the iron gets lifted out and the iron will move. So the iron is magnetic, but the sulfur is not. And that is true of a mixture, that when we look at mixtures, mixtures can be physically separated. And so in this experiment, we're able to separate the mixture because the elements in a mixture, when we just mix elements, still have their individual properties. They have not become a compound. They need to be reacted chemically in some way in order to make a compound. So when we combine iron and sulfur as their elements and just stick them in a test tube together and mix them together, it's like mixing glass beads and sand. The glass and the sand do not react together. They mix, and you will see little round beads of glass, and you'll see the chunks of sand, but they do not combine in any way to make anything special. But when we react them in a proper way, we can form a compound. And here, when we test the compound, what's unique about the compound is that when I put the magnet to it, some of this dust, not a lot, very little bits of this dust, will be grabbed by the magnet, and it is slightly magnetic. And so what we find here is that this is slightly magnetic. As a compound, the compound itself is slightly magnetic. With a strong enough magnet, it will pick up the iron a little bit, and the, not the iron, it will pick up the iron sulfide, the iron 2 sulfide, and will lift the whole compound up. And so the whole compound is slightly magnetic, but not nearly as magnetic as the iron was itself. Okay, so that's the magnetic test. And what we say here is that it is important to note that mixtures can be separated by physical means. So a note that is of importance, mixtures can be separated by physical means. What is going on here? For instance, using a magnet. Compounds, on the other hand, be them ionic or covalent, cannot be separated. By physical means. So that's an important component in what we're doing. Okay, the next thing that we want to do is we want to take these compounds and we want to test these compounds with hydrochloric acid. And the reason that we want to test them with hydrochloric acid is because they have different reactivities with hydrochloric acid. And this is going to point out the differences, one more idea between the differences between elements and their compounds that they form. And this little AQ here, this means dissolved in water. So that's what AQ means. HCl is a gas, but it's a highly soluble gas in water. And when we dissolve it in water, we call it hydrochloric acid. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the test tubes. Once again, let's go back and re-grab our test tubes. And we'll take all four test tubes. And we're going to place them here. And we're going to add HCl to each one of them. And we would use just a squeeze bottle to add some aqueous HCl into the test tube. And as we do that, it fills up with a solution. And so we get the meniscus here as the solution is in there. And once we do that, we find that this one, the iron in particular, when we add HCl into the iron, it gets warm. Gets a little bit hotter, but there's no bubbles and no odor. And so we feel that it gets a little bit warm to the touch, but that's all it really does. It doesn't do anything other than getting a little bit warm. When we take HCl and we add it into the sulfur test tube, what we find is that some of the sulfur rises and floats almost on top of the aqueous solution that is the hydrochloric acid. And so we see some floating material, but it doesn't get warm, there's no bubbles, and there's no odor. So we get some floating sulfur. There is no heat, no bubbles, and no odor. With the mixture, when we take and we add HCl to the mixture, we observe a combination of the first two test tubes. So what we see is that some of the sulfur will float to the surface, and we'll see some of that sulfur sitting and floating on the surface. We also see some of the heat that comes from the iron, but there's no bubbles and there's no odor. So this is a combination of the first two. We get some floating sulfur. We get a little heat. We get no bubbles. And we get no odor. Okay, now HCl, hydrochloric acid, is added to the ionic compound iron 2 sulfide. And what we see in this is that we initially start to get some bubbling that comes out of this. And not only do we get bubbling, but if this is ground into fine enough powder, this whole thing starts to fill with foam. And we get very, very fine gray foam that starts filling the entire test tube. And so that's telling us that a gas is being produced. The bubbles in combination with the foam, and this foam is sort of a light gray in color because it's picking up some of the material that it's bringing up with it. And so we get gas formation. That is both bubbles and foam. We get in here, let's highlight out these different things that are happening. We get some heat. So the test tube gets warm, but then also we get this overwhelming, really bad smell of rotting eggs. We get a rotten egg smell, and it is strong. It is overpowering. You need to do it in a fume hood. And so what is going on here? Why did this react so differently? When we took and we put the HCl into the iron, it got a little warm, didn't do much else. The sulfur did almost nothing, just kind of floated on the surface. And the HCl into the mixture did exactly what the first two did. We just saw a combination of the two elements. But then this thing, the ionic compound, reacted incredibly different and produced this really bad odor. And what is going on there? Well, these guys here are all in their elemental form. But the ionic compound is fundamentally different. So what is it that's different in this one? Why does it foam? Why do we get active bubbling? And we get some heat, it gets very warm. Why does it get very warm? All of these things that are going on. In a chemical reaction sense, what's happening is we are taking iron 2 sulfide and reacting it with HCl, two of these. And what we are producing is we are producing H2S, which is a gas, and we're producing iron 2 chloride, which is in solution in aqueous form. And so this gas, this is what we smell as the rotten egg smell. And if you've ever been any place like Yellowstone Park, where they have thermal vents, where they have all of these geotectonic upwellings of water that come out of the earth, you can also smell sulfur vents. And that sulfur smell is the dihydrogen sulfide, which is coming out of those sulfur vents and gives it that rotten egg smell. And that's what we're smelling here. So why does this reaction take place and not take place for the other things? Well, let's look at the difference between the mixture and the ionic compound. The mixture, this is elemental iron and elemental sulfur. Their electronic configurations, this is an electronic configuration of an argon core with a 3D6 4S2. And sulfur is a neon core with 3S2, 3P4. So we have their elemental electronic configurations, the way that they would be found on the periodic table. Then we take and we look at them as an ionic compound. In the ionic compound, it is now an iron 2 plus, which is an ion. Let's say cation. And the sulfur is a 2 minus anion. Their electronic configurations change as the cation and the anion. It is now that this is an argon core with 3D6 and 4S0. And this whole thing is a 2 positive charge. The sulfur is a neon core with 3S2 and 3P6. And that whole thing has a 2 minus charge. It is the loss of the electrons and the extra electrons which make the difference in how this thing reacts. So we have the non-metal and its electronic configuration for its ion, and we have the metal and its electronic configuration for its ion. And they are very different from their elemental forms. And that's what makes them react differently in this regard with HCl, is the fact that they have different numbers of electrons from their elements. And that in a compound is what makes the compound have different physical properties than the mixture itself, because the mixture is just a mixture of elements. And as long as they have the same electronic configurations, their reactivity is going to be the same. So if I have iron by itself or iron in a mixture, it's always going to react as iron. But if I take that iron and I change its electronic configuration into a cation, then it will have different physical properties. And that's what we see in the ionic compound, is those different physical properties. Okay, so let's go back and let's look at the table of what we're supposed to do here. So in the table of what we're supposed to do, I have now gone through and I have explained these physical properties, and we have looked at these different things in what they look like. So the iron is a shiny gray hard metal. We can even say that it's, in this case, it's a sphere. The sulfur is a yellow powder. The iron and the sulfide is shiny metal spheres mixed with yellow powder. And then the iron to sulfide is a dull gray powder. Okay, the density, the melting point, the boiling point. Let me show you where we can find those. All you have to do is go and Google them, density of iron. If you Google density of iron, it just pops up the density in grams per cubic centimeter, 7.874 for iron. If we Googled the density of sulfur, we could do the same thing. And usually, once you Google an element like that, on the right-hand side, or a compound for that matter, on the right-hand side usually comes up the Wikipedia page that has its density and other physical properties there for you as well. So we could click on that if we wanted to for iron. And I think it will take us, maybe not. Let's go to the Wikipedia one and see. There we go. And down here, it'll give us all the physical properties for that material. It'll give us melting point, boiling point, density, all the things that we're looking for that we need to include in our table. So Wikipedia is a perfectly appropriate source to be able to go and to get these densities, melting points and boiling points. And while we're here, the density, the melting point, and the boiling point for a mixture does not exist. The mixture will not have a unique melting point, boiling point, or density because it is just a combination of the elements themselves. And so we're not going to deal with melting points, boiling points, or densities of mixtures. We're only going to deal with pure substances, be them elements or compounds. So we'll block out those three and we won't need to do those. Magnetic attraction. What did we find for magnetic attraction? Well, I'm going to let you go back and look at the video again and see which of these were magnetic, which were not, and the reaction in odor with HCl, and then the description of the element or compound and what it looks like. So you can go back from my explanation of that experiment and you can fill in the rest of this table for part B. And then there's a few questions. How does the attraction to the magnet differ for the elements, mixture, and the compound? What do the physical properties of iron and sulfur, or why do the physical properties of iron and sulfur differ from those of iron to sulfide? So this is the elements versus the compound. And we gave that explanation of why they differ. That's on the last page of the notes. And can the elements in the iron and sulfur mixture and the compound iron to sulfide be separated using the same methods, i.e. a magnet? That's what they're wanting you to explain there, for instance, a magnet. Okay, then they have a table here or a page of things for us to complete. And I'm gonna leave this mostly for you to complete. I'm just gonna give you some hints that in the first one here, complete the table. They give us compounds. They ask us, what is the unit, ions or molecules? Type of bonds, ionic or covalent? Well, they did the first one for us. And what they said was here is a metal, lithium, and that metals are going to be ions, and that that is going to be ionic in nature. So whenever we see a metal, we're choosing ions and ionic. If it is all non-metals, then we are going to choose molecules and covalent. So we need to make sure that maybe we can find one here that has carbon and chlorine, which would be molecules and covalent. So there's another example. Of how we're picking those out. So if we see a metal, we automatically go for ions and ionic. Then in part two here, list the number of atoms of each kind of element in the following formulas. They're wanting you to break out the subscripts. So here we have two. Let's do it this way. Let's choose green. We have two of the hydrogen atoms. So we're pulling that out, and there is an imaginary one that is here. Let's choose a different color yet, something that we haven't used. So here's my one and my oxygen and my one atom of oxygen. So they're breaking it out by subscript. And so the next one here would be one copper and two chlorines. That's what they're wanting you to do. Be careful of this one. When we have a value outside, that value that is here multiplies by each of the subscripts. So we do multiplication by each of the subscripts by whatever is on the outside of the parentheses. So we need to be careful of that one. And then in the next one, they want us to do the reverse. They're giving us the words, one carbon, two oxygens, and they want us to take it and put it into its formula form, converting each of the values out here into a subscript. And then identify the elements in each compound as a metal or a nonmetal, or two nonmetals. Indicate the bonding type as ionic or covalent. And again, what they're doing is they're looking at whether or not there is a metal, such as barium. That's my metal and my nonmetal. And because of the metal, they're highlighting this out as being ionic. If there was no metal and it was two nonmetals, for instance, what we have here, two nonmetals, carbon and hydrogen, we would say two nonmetals, and we would say covalent. And then indicate whether each of the following is a chemical or physical change. All right, so we need to describe quickly chemical and physical change. A chemical change is an addition, subtraction, or reorganization of the elements in a compound. Addition, subtraction, or recombination. Of the elements in a compound. That compound can be ionic or covalent, makes no difference. If we add elements and there are new elements that appear in the compound, or we take away elements from the compound, or we reorganize the elements in the compound so that they have new ratios, then those new ratios constitute a chemical change. A physical change, then, is only a change in the appearance of a material, meaning that it goes from solid to liquid or liquid to gas. Change of state. So we're going from solid to liquid, or back, or from liquid to solid, or liquid to gas, or back, or we could even go from solid to gas is a possibility too. Also, change in shape. Change in shape. So a change in shape, such as taking a piece of paper and tearing it into smaller pieces, changing the shape of things, or hammering a piece of metal into a new shape, those constitute physical changes as well. So they have pieces here that they want us, or examples here, tearing a piece of paper, burning a match, grinding pepper, rusting a nail iron, an iron nail, freezing water into ice cubes. And so here we're left to figure out whether or not these constitute a chemical change or a physical change. Remember that changing the shape of something or changing its physical state is a physical change, whereas a chemical change usually is a reaction, a chemical reaction between two or more substances. Doesn't have to be. I guess we could look at a decomposition where we take and heat a material and it decomposes into two new things. That would constitute a chemical change too, because it is a reorganization of the atoms forming the compound. So they want us to finish out that piece there. And I think that gets it. I think that is everything that we covered this morning. I'm kind of looking over the notes and I think I've hit everything and reproduced the notes pretty faithfully. So I'm going to upload this, get this online for you guys, and hopefully you find this useful, and we will carry on. All right, have a good afternoon and we'll see you guys on Thursday.